Counsel.
Morning. Thank you, Chief Judge Sentell, and may it please the court. Our petition for review challenges EPA's final rule allocating allowances for the production and consumption of hydrochlorofluorocarbons, HCFCs for short, for the period 2010 through 2014. EPA's proposed rule authorized and recognized both intercompany and interpollutant transfers of HCFCs on both a calendar year and a permanent basis. In other words, the proposed rule allowed four different types of trades. In the final rule, however, EPA refused to allow one of those four types of trades, permanent interpollutant transfers. It is that aspect.
Does that ever mean anything beyond the step down period in which a transfer occurs?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Permanent ever mean anything actually permanent, or does it just refer to the duration of the step period in which such a transfer occurs?
No, permanent clearly means what the ordinary meaning of permanent is.
Where are you drawing permanent from? Put me in the context where you're getting that and finding
it. Sure. I mean, I guess I would direct the court to the prior rule, the language of the prior rule, which is tab 2 of our addendum. This is the final 2003 rule. It's our submission that in this final rule, EPA allowed permanent interpollutant transfers, and permanent in this context means lasting for as long as the system is in effect until chemicals are phased out.
I'm sure that's a possible meaning.
Right. I would direct the court.
More specifically in that tab 2.
I would direct the court to page 2835. Mm-hmm. Which is where EPA discusses these.
Third column there.
That's exactly right. The third column, it says under 7, permanent transfers of baseline allowances. The permanent transfer of baseline allowances is a lasting shift. It goes on to say that in all relevant subsequent years.
Yeah, now that brings us then to what the meaning of relevant is in the context of that rule. And I'm not doubting that what you're suggesting is a possible interpretation of that rule, but is it at all clear that that is the meaning of relevant subsequent years?
Well,
it's very plain it can't mean permanent in a metaphysical sense, because the whole program is not permanent in a metaphysical sense.
That's true.
It's
that's
a step-down program. It's going to end.
That's true.
So this means something other than literally permanent.
Well, that's right. EPA set up a system which, as it was set up in this 2003 rule, contemplated that baseline allowances would be set, and this is EPA's language, on a one-time basis.
Can I go back to that sentence you quoted? That's company-to-company transfers. That's not what you're talking about, right?
Well, the first sentence underneath the heading permanent transfers of baseline allowances refers to intercompany transfers. But later down in the paragraph, EPA says subsequent interpollutant transfers of these baseline allowances would also be permitted.
What do you do with the last sentence of that paragraph?
Well, we think the last sentence of the first paragraph actually supports our position.
No. I don't mean the paragraph. The column.
The
bottom. Right. We think that supports our position also. It says EPA will allow permanent transfers of baseline allowances, with those allowances disappearing at the phase-out date for the specific HCFC. So the permanent transfers, and this is really responsive to Chief Judge Sentell's question, the permanent transfers, the rule says, will disappear at the phase-out date. Now, if phase-out date is when the chemical can no longer be produced, meaning at the very end of the system, whether it's 2020 or 2030 that EPA has put into effect, it doesn't say at the very end of this regulatory period. So we think that supports our position. We also think that the language at the end of the second paragraph supports our position. I'm sorry, the first paragraph supports our position. It uses similar language. At the time of a reduction step or a phase out, the current holder of baseline allowances would be the person who would have them deducted. So it's speaking in terms of the phase out, and that suggests to us that a permanent transfer means as long as this system is in effect. And the system that EPA put into place in 2003 contemplated that baseline allowances would be set once. The only thing that would change from regulatory period to regulatory period was the percentage of the baseline allowance.
The actual regulation, though, which is on 2855, I suppose it's D, Section D, is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. As it just says the controlled substance, et cetera, et cetera, will be the person who has the baseline allowances adjusted in accordance with the phase-out schedule in this section, which doesn't suggest what EPA is arguing in this case, right?
Well, I guess EPA's position is that subsection D supports the view that only calendar year interpollutant transfers are allowed. And as I understand their argument, it's because subsection D refers to a transferee, suggesting that you're dealing with a trade from one company to another. And I think the implication, EPA's implication, is that if you've got an intra-company trade from one pollutant to another, you're not going to have a transferee. But we think that can't be right for a couple of reasons. First of all, if you look at page 2854, which is the facing page, at the very bottom of the third column, this is the, well, actually in the middle of the third column, you have the subsection of that rule on interpollutant transfers.
Right.
And at the very bottom, there is a reference to transferee. So the terminology that EPA employed, and there's one other place which I'll direct the court to in a minute where they did that, but the terminology that EPA employed contemplated that when you had an intra-company trade of a pollutant as opposed to an intercompany trade, you use the same terminology, transferor and transferee. It's just that it's the same company. And in the guidelines, this is the guidance document which is cited in the party's brief, part 4, page 19, says, this is an EPA document, if a person is conducting an interpollutant transfer, the transferee company will be the same company identified in section 1.5. In other words, if A makes an interpollutant transfer, then A is both the transferor and transferee.
Yeah, but Solve itself, you represent Solve?
I represent Arkema, but I'm here arguing on behalf of both companies.
Both companies. Because Solve, if you look at their request for approval, which is JA 3 or 11, is it? Didn't read permanent in the way that you're advocating. I guess it's JA. Yeah, JA 3, if you could turn to that.
That's right.
It says, you know, please note this transfer is for baseline and therefore is being done on a permanent basis, i.e., multi-year transfer 2008-2009.
Well, that's right.
And then it was approved for that, or no objection was taken, which leads me to two questions. And one is the question we're discussing now, right? And two, why haven't they waived the argument you're making by getting what they asked for?
Well, EPA does not take the position that there's any waiver or forfeiture or estoppel, and I don't think they could based on a cover letter that's signed by one representative. But
does it matter what EPA's position is on this?
I think it does. I mean, if you in an adversarial process, I think you can waive waiver, and I don't understand EPA.
There's a Supreme Court case called EEOC versus FORA that dealt with a provision the same as in the Clean Air Act that says no objection not properly raised before the agency can be heard by the court. The Supreme Court said there's no such thing as a waiver of a waiver with respect to that.
Well, be that as it may, even if EPA had asserted a waiver theory as opposed to just raising this for reasons that are unclear to sort of imply that Solvay had a different understanding of the way the system worked, it's a cover letter attached to EPA's own forms. Our submission is that what matters is what EPA's understanding was, what EPA said, and what EPA communicated, not what a cover letter to a form said. The form itself gives the company the choice of transferring current year allowances and baseline year allowances. Solvay and Arkema in its own forms checked baseline year allowances. It's clear from the context of the form that what was going on is that these were interpollutant baseline transfers. EPA authorized a baseline transfer. This is JA9. At the very top, it says allowance type. This is EPA's non-objection notice. Then later on, in connection with the proposed rulemaking in 2009, EPA sent a letter to the companies which sort of updated them on where their baseline allowances stood, and this is JA90 at the top. EPA says the table below compares, and then I'm skipping, the current baselines for your company updated to reflect permanent trades of baseline allowances. So EPA created this system in which permanent trades could be made either interpollutant or intercompany. Arkema and Solvay made them, and then EPA approved them. Beyond this, it seems to us it's...
But the approval was only for, if you go to JA 33, the approval was only for the period ending at the phase-out, that first stage of phase-out, right?
I'm not sure where you're reading from, Judge Randolph.
The next to last paragraph.
Right. I mean, all that says, it says production allowances and consumption allowances may only be expended during the 12-month control period in which they were received. Unexpended allowances may not be carried over from one control period to another. All that means is that you cannot transfer allowances across years. The trades have to be made within a year. But that doesn't say that if you make a trade within a year, that that trade doesn't continue to carry forward in each successive year. And just to give the court an example, if you have 100 allowances of A and 100 allowances of B in a particular year, and you assume you have the same ozone depletion potential so that you can trade one for one, all that means is what the statute says, which is that you can make a trade so that in that same year you will have 0 of A and 200 of B, but you can't make a trade so that in year one you have 0 of A, 100 of B, and then in year two you have 100 of A and 200 of B. And the reason is clear, because if you allow that sort of cross-year trading, there's a risk that the United States will be in violation of the Montreal Protocol. I do want to turn to our second principal submission, which is that EPA mistakenly believed that its position was compelled by the Clean Air Act. And there's a long line of decisions of this court, beginning with a case called Prill, which hold that when an agency mistakenly believes that its position is compelled by statute, the action has to be set aside. And in the final rule, EPA took the position that the Clean Air Act prohibits permanent interpollutant.
Well, they said the best interpretation. I don't know if that means it's compelled. That's the language you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's right. And I'm now in tab 4 on page 66421. This is the final rule where EPA is addressing the availability of different types of transfers and explaining that it's not going to allow permanent interpollutant transfers. And we submit the justification for that conclusion occurs in the carryover paragraph at the bottom of 66421, going over to the next page. It says the language and the legislative history permits only year by year interpollutant transfers. On the next
best
page,
read as you did your
best read
you're that, paraphrasing. You're not quoting.
No, best read. Look,
best read as permitting only year by year intertransfers.
That's true. Our point is that using the term best read does not move something from Chevron step one to Chevron step one.
Isn't Chevron itself an instance when EPA, you know, in interpreting the bubble thing, said the best reading of this or the best is the one we come up with, and then the Supreme Court said they were in step two?
Actually, in Chevron, my recollection is that EPA said in adopting the rule at issue, we don't think the statute or legislative history answers this question. It was what would come to be a classic Chevron step two situation.
So you do the best you can. You do the best, you know, what's the best reading?
Yeah. Well, our point is that if EPA had been engaged in a Chevron step two interpretation, you would have seen some language that is suggestive of that. You would have.
It also be said that had they been at a Chevron step one, they would not have said is best read. They would have said may only be read as permitting.
I respectfully disagree with that. I mean,
I know that's why you're here. You wouldn't be arguing this.
It's not just I disagree. I actually have a reason for disagreeing. It's hardly unusual in an ordinary civil or criminal case outside of the administrative context, where a court is interpreting a statute de novo, as it ordinarily does, to consider the competing possibilities, apply all of the tools of statutory interpretation, and at the end of the analysis say, we think the statute is best read to mean X. That doesn't mean that the court is deferring to, anything. It means that it has gone through the process, employed all the ordinary tools of statutory construction, and come up with the conclusion that this is the best reading of the statute.
See, the difference is that in cases like Prill and PDK and some of the others, what occurred in those cases was the agency did not consider any policy considerations whatsoever. They picked the statute up, they took a look at it, and they said, well, there's only one meaning here, and so we don't have to consider any of the policy implications or anything else. We just won't go through any of the analysis that one would expect in Chevron Step 2. And so that left the court in a situation where if we upheld the interpretation under Step 2, the court would be in a position of making a policy choice for the agency, which is the agency's. So we sent it back. But that's not true here. I mean, the agency went through a whole host of policy considerations.
Well, let me talk about the policy considerations that are identified in the agency's brief. I think there are several important points to be made. The first is that a great many of them simply don't appear in the final rule. They appear in a separate document where there are comments and responses to comments. So the final rule, by its own terms, does not rely on the number.
You don't mean the rule itself. You mean the preamble.
Well, that's right. Not the codified part in the Code of Federal Regulations, but the preamble. The second point is that if you read the policy considerations such as they are in the preamble, for the most part, EPA is simply reciting what commenters have said without explicitly endorsing them. The third thing I would say is that, and this gets back to our first point, is that insofar as there are policy considerations that are not merely identified in the final rule but affirmatively endorsed by the agency, a great many of them, maybe even all for that matter, rest on the premise that the agency's prior policy was not to allow this type of transfer. For example, the agency says it would disrupt the market, it would upset expectations of other companies. But all of that presupposes that permanent interpollutant transfers were not previously allowed. If they were, as we submit, then the market expectations and the upsetting of reliance on what EPA allowed would be precisely to the contrary. And the final point I would make on the policy considerations is this. My understanding of this court's cases and administrative law principles generally is that if you have a permissible ground and an impermissible ground for agency action, it's got to be set aside, except in the unusual circumstance where a court can tell that the agency would have come out the same way. As, for example, where the agency says, we've got independent grounds for this, this is an alternative ground. You have nothing like that here. And this is a corollary of the Chenery principle. You have to, an agency action stands or falls on the justifications that the agency itself employed. And there's just no way to know whether if this court were to disabuse the agency of the idea that the statute tied its hands, it would come out the same way based on some of the policy considerations it's identified in its brief. Insofar as I have any time left, I'd like to reserve the remainder for rebuttal.
Time, but we'll give you back a couple of minutes.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Perry Rosen for the Department of Justice. With me today is Diane McConkie from EPA. Let me go to Mr. Himmelfarb's last point regarding what was said about interpretation of the statute. This is not a Chevron 1 case, nor did EPA say it was a Chevron 1 case. If you look in Section 607, the key terms, permanent, baseline, are not even in that statute and nowhere else defined. This was an interpretation in one single paragraph in the preamble of the rulemaking. After all of the policy statements were made,
but EPA, it does seem that the agency is setting forth in that interpretation the framework by which it's going to conduct the rest of this rulemaking. That is to say, if we read that as meaning that the agency believed that 607B permitted only year-by-year interpollutant transfers, that seems to be what it says, then from there on, the die is cast. It doesn't matter that it's only one sentence. There's only one river that Caesar crossed when he cast the die.
It says that the best reading of the statute.
Yeah,
that
so that's the ditch you want to die in on this part of the case. It's not that this is unimportant or it's not controlling. It is controlling.
But
you're going to have to be right to win on that point. It's not good enough to say it's just a small thing. It's not a small thing.
And given the deference that's afforded to EPA and the interpretation of that provision, that should be upheld.
You understand the petitioner's argument is that they're not entitled to the deference here because you're only entitled to respect for your deference if you know you have the deference. And petitioner is arguing that by its interpretation that this is a binding interpretation of the statute, that this is the only way they can do those interpollutant transfers. They're saying that deprives them of the deference from then on because you can only exercise discretion if you know you have it.
Well, certainly if the agency goes into and engages in an interpretation of the statute, it's exercising that deference. It's going
Wouldn't
through that
it be
interpretation.
If they process. Only said in the cases that were cited by Judge Randolph, that if they had only said, we look at this statute and there's only one possible interpretation, then you understand you would not be entitled to Chevron deference, right?
I would agree that if they said that they were restricted by Congress in what can or cannot be done,
right,
how that could be interpreted, that it's clear on the face under Chevron 1, then the agency would be so restricted.
Well, Mr. Rosen, let me ask you about this language at 66422. It says, hence, EPA interprets Section 607 as requiring that all interpollutant transfers, whether occurring between companies or within a single company, be conducted on a yearly and thus temporary basis.
Yes, and that is what any agency would say when it interprets a statute. When it gives the best reading to a statute, it doesn't say.
No, that's not what any agency would say. Counsel, we have agencies talking to us all the time.
Okay.
And they don't always say that we interpret the statute as requiring that. They would often say, in light of the things we set forth in the paragraph before, we interpret the statute to allow us to require that the transfer be done only on a year-by-year basis. This is not the language that, it's not necessarily inconsistent with a Chevron 2 position, but it's not the language we would ordinarily see in Chevron 2.
Well, if we then go and tell the agency to interpret the statute, again, to use its discretion, we'd be right back here in the exact same place because that's what it did. It used its discretion to interpret that statute, and that's the deference that should be afforded. If you look at the statute itself, I mean, let's get to the interpretation. The statute is clear, 607B, the interpollutant transfer provision, says that the rules that EPA establishes for those transfers shall afford allowances for any year to be transferred for the same year. The mandate under 607A says that the whole process, the whole program, has to be administered in a way so that any transfer will result in greater total reductions in each year.
That's going well beyond the question, though, when you get to that second part. It has been EPA's position all the time that baseline transfers can extend longer than the given year. Has it not?
No, it has not. Not interpollutant baseline transfers.
It has not?
It has not.
Why did they send no objection responses consistently to requests that were made for precisely that?
Well, first of all, it was a mistake, because EPA had said in its earlier
report. That's not good enough. Well, EPA has a practice, comes in by rule, and dictates a differing practice, which sounds to me like it's differing even more this morning than it did in the record. But you can't come in, we were just mistaken. You have to go on record and say how you were mistaken, and they didn't do that.
Yes, they did. It's exactly what they did, because it's
laid. Show me where.
It's laid out in the proposed rule. In the proposed,
they had five different possibilities.
They had five different possibilities, which shows why a permanent transfer in the last step through 2009 cannot possibly apply in the new step, because five.
That's a different question.
I understand that.
That's not the same question. That's the question I was asking opposing counsel.
That's right.
Permanent may well just mean within that step, but even though it's a multi-year step. But it's a different thing for EPA to now be saying, and as you are arguing, that baseline transfers don't extend beyond a given year. I thought that's what the baseline was.
No. An intercompany baseline transfer, yes, if it's approved. But baseline transfers do not
extend. You're getting again to a different question.
Right. It doesn't extend beyond
EPA
that.
EPA seems to be making the, I think, difficult argument that you can't have an intracompany interpollutant transfer.
You can on an annual basis, which is exactly what the statute provides for. But an interpollutant transfer cannot extend into a new regulatory period, and even into another year.
One thing that's sort of missing from your argument, and you may be getting to it, but I'm anxious to hear. I think I understand it, but I'd like to hear you explain. In the preamble to the final rule, EPA talked about the incentive to manipulate if you allowed interpollutant transfers.
Right.
And explain what that means.
Okay. They gave several examples in the preamble. One is the example we have here. What the petitioners did was take an HCFC that was coming close to elimination and basically create new HCFC allowances in the one that was surviving into the next regulatory period. They took the 142B, which is now set at 0.5% of baseline, and they created through those, they transferred them over into HCFC 22 allowances. So they basically created a much larger baseline.
How would that be any different with respect to an intracompany interpollutant transfer than it would be with an intercompany interpollutant?
In the end, it would not. An interpollutant transfer.
It just takes more people to manipulate, but the manipulation is precisely the same. So I don't understand the policy argument that says we can't have intracompany transfers for more than a year. You can't have intercompany transfers for more than a year. Well, why? Because if it's intracompany, they can manipulate. They can do the same manipulation intercompany.
Well, again,
doesn't make sense, counsel.
The intracompany, the interpollutant transfers were limited by statute to a single year. If you go to intercompany transfers, they are typically the same.
You can't quote a clear statute that simply says that, though. I understand that your position depends upon interpreting the statutes to that effect, but that's not something that you can stand here and give me a clean quote that says this is the way it is, and you're quoting Congress when you say it.
Well, I agree with that, but I think the legislative history supports that also.
I thought the EPA itself said the legislative history is not very helpful here.
We did not say that. We said there wasn't a great deal of legislative history, but we said it's pretty clear.
Even so, Congress never enacted the legislative history, did it?
No, it did not.
Right. And that may help your interpretation if we're at Chevron 2, but legislative history can't make it a clear answer like you're contending for.
Can I go back to that question? What I get is that various hydrofluorocarbons have different phase out periods, right? And so if one is going close to a phase out period, you transfer that to one that has less of a percentage of phase out in a longer period of time, right?
Yes, to give
it. Okay, and then you get if in fact that's a quote permanent then your baseline is set according to the new transfer. Is that right?
You know, an example would be, another example in the preamble is, as we get in 2020, HCFC 22s, which is the main HCFC at issue here, is going to be phased out completely. In 2019, a company can transfer all of their HCFC 22 allowances into another allowance that's going to survive. So they take the allowances for a chemical that is supposed to be phased out, and they create a new baseline. Right. And by able
to, and so the amount of hydrofluorocarbons, wherever they are, that go into the atmosphere will not change despite the phase out.
Yes, it will change. In fact, ARCMA admits in its stay brief that it will, if this transfer goes through, it will produce over 4,000, close to 5,000 extra metric tons of HCFC 22, which would not otherwise be there. Well, and the number is actually 8,000.
That's what I was trying to say, right?
Yes.
Okay. And then is it also, in terms of manipulation, also possible that they could switch back after the baseline is set?
They could switch again to an existing HCFC that still exists. So if it's down to whatever percentage it was, they can transfer again. They can transfer on an annual basis.
Now, if in fact they're not permitted to have their baseline set on something that on a transfer that occurred previously, how is the baseline then set?
The baseline is set by EPA for every step down period.
No, do you ignore the previous transfer? Is that how you set the baseline?
The transfers do not move unless it's an intercompany transfer of the same pollutant, which has no effect on the total
overall,
U.S. cap.
Right.
That's right. And that's why generally those are permitted. This would have a significant effect. The effect would be EPA would have to do one of three different
things. See, I think you either misunderstood or misanswered Judge Santel's question. Because you said it wouldn't have any effect. Intercompany versus interpollutant, no difference. But in fact, there's a huge difference, isn't it?
Yes, I'm sorry if I misunderstood your question.
I don't think you did. What I was asking was if there's a difference in intracompany interpollutant transfers and intercompany interpollutant transfers as far as the ability to manipulate. I think Judge Randolph may have misunderstood.
Okay. Technically, there is no difference other than it's easier to trade with yourself than to trade with someone else.
It's easier, but so far as the effect and the possibility of manipulation, it's still the same with intercompany interpollutant transfers or intracompany interpollutant transfers.
That's true. And intercompany intrapollutant transfers are not permitted.
You say that the ability to manipulate makes it reasonable to forbid an intracompany interpollutant transfer in a circumstance in which an intercompany interpollutant transfer would be permissible.
That's correct. They are the same rules apply to both of those.
Very difficult
types
to make
of
a clear statement of what a question is on this.
I still don't get it, but go on.
That's what they're counting on. Right.
Here's where it comes out. Here's where it comes out in the end. If this transfer is allowed to go through, either there will be more pollutants in the air as a result of that, or EPA will have to make one of two adjustments. They'll have to take allowances away from every other manufacturer, every other producer, most of whom had no opportunity to do this because they didn't have two different HCFCs types of allowances. Or they'd have to take it from the reclamation program, which ARCMA itself says is critical to meeting the caps in the future.
I'm not sure if I understand how that's a winning argument for you. One set of companies is going to be better off, and one set of companies is going to be worse off, whichever way.
In the end, what this regulation does is put everyone on the same playing field. What the petitioners are trying to do is use those transfers to manipulate their way into larger baselines, which require everyone else's historic baseline to be reduced just to accommodate
happens,
them.
I mean, this is all implementing the Montreal Protocol, right?
Correct.
What are other countries doing?
Other countries, some use what's called the worst first system that we have here. Many do not. Many use what's called the ozone depletion potential.
Have cap and trade?
Some do and some don't, I believe. But because we have this worst first system here, EPA wants to protect the integrity of that system. It's determined twice in two different rulemakings that it's the
worst
best,
first
that
is the just best one system. Step of what brings us here. It's only the fact that there can also be transfer. Using worst first does not inherently involve using transfer, does it?
No, it doesn't. No, the statute, it doesn't. It's the statute that sets out that transfer should be permitted.
Right. And what I was asking, or what I think we're asking, is do other countries have these transfer mechanisms?
I believe a number of countries have similar transfer mechanisms, but I can't cite them. They're not in the record.
Okay. Any more questions? If not, then we have taken you slightly beyond your time, but only slightly, which for us is pretty good.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Himmelfarb.
Thank you, Chief Judge Sentelle. Just to get to this colloquy that Judge Randolph was having with Mr. Rosen, recognizing the interpollutant transfers, the permanent interpollutant transfers, will not increase the total amount of the chemical at issue, the HCFC-22 at issue. It's capped. It's the cap, I believe, is 25,000 metric tons. That was the cap under the proposed rule. It's the cap under the final rule. It's just a question of which companies get to produce them. The percentage under the, because under the proposed rule, the transfers were recognized, the percentage had to be lower to equal that 25,000 metric ton cap. Because the transfers were not recognized under the final rule, you had a smaller number of them, the percentage was higher. This notion of, you know, just wanting to have the same playing field for every company, I think that was Mr. Rosen's terminology. Again, this presumes that these permanent interpollutant transfers were not allowed. If they were, in fact, allowed before, the same playing field means you recognize them when they were made.
Tell me where I'm wrong about this. I'm going to try to simplify it down, okay? Let's suppose you have two different kinds of pollutants, and one, your allocation is 10, right? And whatever it is, you know, pounds, you know, kilograms, or it's 10. And the other one is 5, and it's 2009. Now, you know this is the end of the first phase-out period, and the one that you have that has 5 is going to be phased out to 0. And right before, in December 2009, you transfer your allocation 5 to the other pollutant, which gives you, assume they're equal, 15, right? And now the year ends. Now, if you had not done that transfer, and if it were not permanent, then you would have been only had 10 that you could throw into the atmosphere. But now you have 15 if you're correct. What mistake am I making?
Well,
I think there's
one mistaken premise in the hypothetical. Under the proposed rule, there was a cutoff date for making permanent transfers, whether interpolar.
Oh, yeah, but all right, do it in June. I don't.
No, I think this is an important point because it goes to the question of the likelihood of manipulation. The cutoff was in mid-2008. So that minimizes the risk that you're going to have manipulation.
Well, you know, yeah, but you, in anticipation of that, you can do it whenever. I mean, it doesn't seem to be critical to the hypothetical. As long as you have notice and you know when the cutoff date is and you know when the phase out period ends.
Right. Is it true?
Here's the bottom line. Is it true that under your theory, given my hypothetical, you can pollute to 15, whereas under EPA's, you can only pollute to 10?
Yes. I mean, that's the nature of an interpollutant transfer. And if they're carried forward, then that would be the effect. I do want to say one last thing, if the court will allow me. I think I heard Mr. Rosen say, I may be mistaken about this, that the statute, indeed, in EPA's view, does prohibit the recognition of permanent interpollutant transfers. I thought I heard him say that when he was standing here. So you've got the final rule that we have said all along, said exactly that. You've got EPA's brief on the merits, which I thought had said, no, it's not Chevron step 1, it's Chevron step 2. But now Mr. Rosen, I think, is representing to the court that indeed the agency's hands were tied. If that's true.
Well, counsel, is it possible, and I realize this is an academic exercise in a sense, but it's not in another, is it possible in a Chevron analysis to say at step one the statute is ambiguous, we can't tell whether it binds us or not, but then in step two to say we've applied the tools of statutory construction, we're now determined that it appears the statute does bind us. The best interpretation is so that it does bind us.
That's not my understanding of the way Chevron works. My understanding is that you apply the tools of statutory construction at step one. If at the very end of the process you still have an ambiguity or a silence or a gap, you go to step two.
Then at step two, you have to choose the best interpretation.
That's true, but it's ordinarily based on policy considerations that are within.
Not necessarily, though.
Well, I think that's ordinarily the case. I don't know what else. I mean, I guess the agency could look to sort of general principles that it perceives to be behind the statute.
Well, we have to do that when we interpret statutes, and we certainly shouldn't be using policy interpretations, policy considerations, except insofar as we determine Congress's. But when we do an analysis of a statute, we might read it as a court and find that it's very clear on its face and so apply it. If we don't, then we have to re-employ the tools of statutory interpretation, figure out what's the best interpretation, don't we?
That's right. But if
you sometimes that best interpretation is going to be a very mandatory one, isn't it?
Well, if you are outside the administrative law context, if you're in the ordinary civil or criminal context, and you've employed all of the ordinary tools of construction and you get to the end and you're still in doubt about the meaning of the statute, I think ordinarily there are tie-breaking canons that courts would apply in the criminal context, for example, the rule of lenity.
That's not nearly that easy, counsel.
Well,
for every canon you can come up with, you can nearly always, I think Judge Randolph put this into an opinion once, you can nearly always find a countervailing canon.
That's true. That's true. If
we have to take those and figure out which is the best interpretation.
That's true. Our point is that in the final rule, there is nothing suggestive of the notion that there is a gap, a silence, or even an ambiguity. EPA seems to be saying, as Mr. Rosen, as I understood him, said to the court, was of the view that the statute simply tied its hands.
You've imposed on everybody's time well past the allotted time here, so my colleagues probably are tired of hearing me and you have a dialogue anyway, so at this point then we'll submit the case. Thank you, counsel. Call the next case.